Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Cynica Podcast, the weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to the way we think and talk about China. Cynica is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Cynica podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I'm doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support. You can get me at cynicapod@gmail.com. And listeners, please support my work on Substack at cynica.substack.com. There you will find, in addition to the podcast, the complete transcript of the show, a weekly essay from me, and now a wide range of offerings: James Carter's This Week in China's History, Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf, Andrew Methvin's Chinese Phrase of the Week, the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, and the outstanding China Global South podcast, as well as a weekly essay from the brilliant and very deeply informed folks at the China Global South Project. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you this week from Seattle, Washington. Several years ago, I was asked to speak at a small event, a gathering of people who were advisory board members for a small investment fund, and the convener had a question that he likes to put to people in situations like that, or even at parties, where he simply asks them, "What is something that has become clear to you recently?" So I decided to take that same idea and to put that question to people that I ran into at AAS, at the Association for Asian Studies conference in Seattle in mid-March this year. So here's what some of them said. "Hey, so I just ran into Michael Davidson from UC San Diego, who listeners might remember from the show that we did on emissions trading markets. That was, gosh, Michael, when was that?"
"That was probably 2 years ago now."
"Yeah, it's like 2 years ago. I mean, even older, but anyways, it's one of the best conversations I've ever had about carbon trading systems. So let me ask you a question here. What is something that has become clear to you recently in the field?"
"Well, thanks, Kaiser. That's a tough question to answer. I think, you know, as someone who studies climate change and clean energy transitions, I think there's actually an enormous amount of optimism just in the last few years about the scale of development and deployment and clean energy, and how much progress we've made in deploying some of the important technologies that we need in order to achieve climate change goals. And China is probably one of the leading examples in this front. Last year, they deployed almost 300 gigawatts of wind and solar compared to about 40 gigawatts in the United States, which is still a very substantial amount. And we just had a study out last month, PNAS, that showed what China would need in order to achieve its 2060 carbon neutrality target. And we put at basically the later period, about 300 gigawatts per year installations necessary. So China has already made enormous progress towards getting at that level of deployment that's needed in order to achieve climate change goals. But the other thing that was made really clear to me from that analysis is the substantial challenges that remain in terms of finding appropriate land, as well as developing the right markets in electricity systems to integrate those new renewable technologies. That's something that China is going to have to overcome, and many other countries are going to have to overcome in order to achieve our mid-century climate goals.
That evening at one of the many parties, I ran into Timothy Cheek. Tim teaches at the University of British Columbia, and he works on intellectuals and the state. So I asked him, what is something that has become clear to you about our field recently?
I think the one thing that's really become clear to me in our field is that we're going to have to live with this, with Xi Jinping. And what does that mean? And it means some of us can't go. It means those who can go to China can't do what we did and what we now think of as the golden age, I guess, between 95 and 2015, more or less. But for me, the big thing is we have to continue trying. That's the big thing. That's the big thing for me. So the one big thing I've learned is we have to keep trying. We all know the troubles between U.S. and China. We all know about repression with Xi Jinping. But what I've learned with my old contacts is you have to keep trying. And we have pressure in Canada as much as Americans do. Of course, we have trouble with authorities in China. But we're also having trouble with authorities in our home country. And we've got real pressure on our STEM scholars from our central government that is politicized and plays to local politics. And so my colleagues in Canada, we're working to support our Chinese colleagues on the one hand, and both in China, in Canada, but also the ones in China, because they say, don't stay away. Please come. Yeah, okay, maybe we just have dinner and we just talk about, you know, life. But, you know, think about it, Kaiser. Our teachers couldn't go, period, you know, or had, you know, and we've had 40 years of reform and opening. This is the repression or the constraints of the moment are no joke, and they're serious. I've got colleagues who can't go and would fear for themselves if they would go in the Hong Kong, you know, security law, etc. But many of us can go, and we should, and our students can go. And by go, I mean come and go. And I'm delighted that we're beginning to get all our old colleagues and their students coming to our university.
I think this summer is going to change a lot. I think everyone I know is planning a trip. So I'm glad to hear that. Fantastic. Thanks, Tim.
There you go.
So the very next morning, Tim actually chaired a paper panel that I had the pleasure of attending. And I talked to two scholars who are both working on things related to the Chinese propaganda system. It turns out that they're actually married to one another. So first I speak to Chen Zifeng and then to Wang Yicheng. So I'm with Chen Zifeng. Zifeng Chen, who is a PhD student, actually doing her second PhD at LSE. And I'm asking her today at AAS, she just gave a terrific paper, what is something that has become clear to you about our field recently?
Hi, so I'm doing China politics and cyber politics. It has become clear the role of propaganda and the nature of propaganda. I used to think that propaganda is all about text, about thoughts, about like either playfully by state media participating in public discourses or like a top-down implanting thoughts into people's head. But gradually I figured out that there are also substantial material aspects of propaganda. So maybe everything could be propaganda and oh, there's no propaganda at all. Say, like during the COVID-19, the bare fact that you are locked down and people wearing dabai coming in and outside your apartment, and also you have to do the PCR test every day, they could impact your political opinion alongside what is told from the top down. So the very existence of those people around you, they persuade you into that, okay, the pandemic is really serious. And also, in order to navigate the conditions so you live live on every day, you have to adopt, even critically or even utilitarianly, certain aspects from the state propaganda. So, like, people, they just voluntarily watch the media release, the media conference every day. It never happened before, but people are now doing it willingly because, yes, there are material aspects in it. And also, like, it could be really flexible. At the beginning of year 2024, people were, the Central Department of Propaganda and the local propaganda departments, they were trying to persuade people into traveling. So I could not imagine that propaganda is used in traveling promotion. So the state media and media of local governments, they cooperate with influencers and they paid for them, and also they use their own media account as influencers in really playful way to ask people to consume in certain theme parks, in certain restaurants, but it's also propaganda because it serves the purpose to accelerate economy and to ask the people to contribute by consuming more.
It reminds me of after September 11th in the United States, you know, we were being urged to get out and consume. It's like I saw a New Yorker cartoon where two guys were drinking in a bar and one said, if we don't have this third martini, the terrorists win.
Yes, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. And we could see even slogans printed on the wall or on newspapers. So, like, spare our food for the travelers, spare the scenery for the travelers, spare the road for the traffic, for the vehicles of those travelers. So it is traveling and consumption in the mode of mass campaign. It's really fascinating and maybe ridiculous.
That's great. Thank you so much. That's so cool. Yeah. Propaganda as built environment and propaganda as sort of, yeah, the material environment. That's fascinating insight. Thank you. So I'm with Wang Yicheng from Washington and Lee University. And I wanted to ask you, what is one thing in the field that has become clear to you recently?
So one thing that had been clear to me in my main research recently was that the Chinese propaganda system has been riding the tide of the market and the social media. And, well, this may sound kind of cliche to a lot of people, but there has been a lot of differentiation, actually, within the official media. And that's my kind of major thing. And different levels of the social media kind of send different signals, and they, at least they intend to do so. And the importance and authoritativeness of the official media, if it's published by the People's Daily or if it's published by the Enlightenment Daily, are vastly different. And they also have different levels of success, and they have different levels of, interestingness, I guess. They have been attracting the audience with very different and subtle strategies. One thing was they developed different kind of interesting virtue persona that they use to portray themselves. Some the official media are behaving like, one official media worker told me that they were kind of like a cheerful uncle that you meet on the street and they talk to you about recent news, and they adopt that style. And meanwhile, some official media are using the style that is kind of middle age or elderly age, kind of 中老年, the chatting style that they attract different audiences, and a lot of them cook the so-called chicken soup for the sale, and that has a lot of success as well.
So it's not just the, you know, TGNA government officials who are using social media in different ways. I just heard you give a session here at AAS on intellectuals from Mao Zedong, and you talked about a new left intellectual who is using Bilibili and cashing in, not just riding the wave, but actually cashing in. You said it was like 128 yuan to download a speech, and there are 20 million people who have done that. I'm sorry, 2 million people. And there are 2 million people who have already done that. Tell me a little bit about him.
Intellectuals in China, pro-state intellectuals in China, have been very active on social media nowadays. The major platform they use are the video platforms such as Bilibili and another video platform like Guan Shipin, which is loosely attached to the Guancha Zhewang, which is a kind of a famously nationalist outlet, and they have been publishing articles and also making classes to sell to the audiences. And they have been kind of adopting this kind of populist language that is just, you know, extending from their traditional theme of the New Left in the 1990s, which was criticizing Euro-American hegemonism, cultural colonialism, and criticizing the capitalist development, and especially linking up to the global neoliberal economy. And that criticism, I would say, has a lot of valid aspects. In recent years, however, it has gradually taken a statist transformation that is putting praises on the state policy, whether that was capitalist or not. And they have emphasized more of the development of state capacity over equality or redistribution. And they have used the kind of very us versus them language, blaming, you know, siding with the Chinese government while blaming the big capitals, especially Western capitals, for sabotaging China's development. And that kind of very, there's this very populist dichotomy, right, has been appealing to a lot of young audiences who tend to follow a certain version of Maoism. But this version of Maoism is not this kind of, you know, making rebellions against the government, right, bombarding a headquarter type of Maoism, but instead is the anti-nationalist, anti-Western, cracking down on capital, that kind of Maoism. So
you just gave a paper about this, about the New Left. Where can we find it, and what's the title of the paper?
The title now is still in the work. It's still a working paper. I will put a preprint version of this paper on my personal website. So if you're very interested, just search my name, Clyde Yicheng Wong, and I guess you can find it. But I will upload it sometime later. But at least you can check my other articles there. So
I will. Thank you very much, Clyde. All right, great to talk to you. I wandered up to the exhibition area where all the publishers and different services that do things like digitization of archives and things like that, where they all have their exhibits. Really fascinating stuff. And I ran into my old friend Jeff Wasserstrom, who teaches, of course, at UC Irvine. So let's hear what he had to say when asked, what is something that has become clear to him recently?
What's become clear to me is that a lot of the most interesting projects now are China and projects. China and some other part of the world. There are people doing things for multiple reasons. I think, you know, China and Southeast Asia. There used to be very few things about that. Now with diasporas, but also with connections between events in different places. And some of it is when you have a harder time going to China or not, you start thinking about what can I do that's related to China but involves going somewhere else or thinking beyond it. But also, I think events in China, the white paper protests in 2022, slogans in Beijing were kept alive outside of China in places like the US and UK by Chinese students studying there and then circulated back into China. So there are a lot of things that have been making it clear that things flowing into and out of China, even at times of less connection, are really crucial to how things happen culturally, politically, and other ways.
Sitting next to Jeff was another old friend. Let's see what he had to say. Ian Johnson from CFR. He's been on the show recently, of course, but for his excellent book, Sparks. What is something that has become clear to you recently?
In terms of China studies, what's become clearer to me is that many people are finding ways to research China without going to China. And this is, of course, a bad thing that people feel they can't go to China or they're not getting access. But in a positive way, I was really impressed by the work of people like Daniel Lees, who's got this Maoist Legacy Project, and they have thousands and thousands of documents, and they're finding...
He's at Freiburg, right?
He's at Freiburg, yeah, University of Freiburg, and they're finding new ways to make these scannable, searchable, tag them. You can do tons of research, and I think we're just beginning now to mine stuff that came out of China in this incredibly open period in the 90s and 2000s. Nowadays, you can't get access to documents like that, but we're still finding ways, thanks to technology, to make use of them. So that'll keep things going a little bit further. But in the long run, I think it is a bad trend that we can't get into China, and I'm concerned about that in the long run.
Last time we talked, you had the recommendation of this new archive that you're a part of sort of what, alternative histories, or whatever we want to call them. You had a name for it. Update us really quickly on the progress of that.
Yeah, the site is up. We have over 850 items. We're going to redo it a bit because, and a bit inspired by Professor Lees's work, I want to make this into a searchable database with more tags. And so we need to have a proper database software, something like Omeka, which is an academic database. Right now, it's just the stuff is there. You can't search in the text. And we're going to have to make the PDFs searchable using OCR technology. It's all doable, but it just became clear to me after the site went live and we got feedback from readers that to make it really much more useful, we can do that. And then we can do data visualization. We can show where are the authors of these works? What are they writing about? We can put it on a map of China, and I think that will reveal interesting things about the diversity of writing on China, how it's not just Beijing and Shanghai or a few places like that. So that's, to me, what we're going to be focusing on.
Thanks, Ian. Have a good meeting, man. So, speak of the devil, Ian just mentioned Daniel Lees at the University of Freiburg. And I want to shout out Freiburg because Freiburg, the God offices of Dr. Amanda Schumann, has provided innumerable excellent, excellent interns. I don't like to call them interns. They've just been people who've, you know, colleagues who've helped out so much with the China Project and with other things that I've done. So anyway, he mentioned Daniel Lees and about digitization. But Daniel, what is something that has become clear to you recently about our field?
With regard to digitization? One of the big issues that we have is that tons of our Chinese colleagues and ourselves, we have millions and millions of JPEG files flowing around, people taking photos somewhere of bad quality, and it's very difficult to make use of them. So what we've been working at in Freiburg for the past, let's say, 10 years is to find strategies of getting good quality OCRs that are full-text searchable that others then can actually use. Yeah, and so we're working on all kinds of, let's say, not really cost-intensive devices like small scan tents or whatsoever, that people who go to the archives actually get good quality work that we can later then OCR and make accessible for others. So this is one of, I think, the big things that we need to accomplish in the next couple of years.
How much has the advent of really good computer vision of AI especially helped that process?
I mean, in most cases, I would say this is much more low-tech, what we're doing. So what you basically do is a very good OCR software, and otherwise I think we don't use much AI in that particular process. What we're doing is digitizing, archiving, and I think where things probably from an AI perspective get more helpful is translation issues. Yeah, sort of trying to get some of these things in a format that is readable for colleagues who don't read Chinese. But I've just edited a volume of recent articles by Chinese intellectuals. I ran some of them through currently the best translation software, and still you need the skills of trained sinologists. At this point, we're not yet useless, I would say.
No, I've run into the same problem. But I have found that OCR sometimes doesn't handle caoshu very well.
Yeah, you're absolutely on point with this. I mean, we have a huge collection of personal files and other things, and we can't OCR them at this point. Yeah, so there's one very active German consortium called Transcribus, which is working mostly on, let's say, Western medieval handwritten files, and we've just started, or we're in the process of doing a small collaboration working on Chinese handwritten texts. And I mean, this is, of course, would be something that would take it a whole step further. But currently, I mean, OCR with good quality printed text is 98% or above. Yeah, so that works pretty well.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Hey, so I'm now with Tyler Harlan, who was one of the co-organizers along with Juliet Liu, who you met last year on the show, who put together this amazing double panel yesterday. That was on Friday afternoon. That was on U.S.-China climate cooperation in this age of, what do we call it?
Geopolitical tension.
So, Tyler, I'm asking people, what is something that's become clear to you recently about our field? And I expect fully that you will answer with something having to do with the environment.
Thanks for having me on, Kaiser. Yeah, I think being at this conference and seeing how many people are working on China and the environment in this particular moment, where there is a lot of geopolitical tension, but where we still want cooperation to happen, right? There is rising competition in all kinds of fields. It is bleeding into the environmental domain. In fact, it's already there. Think about competition in EVs and renewables and grids. But there's still a lot of cooperation, too, in climate change and biodiversity. The COP15 Biodiversity Summit last year, which I attended virtually, and Juliet and our colleague Jesse Rodenbiker attended in person, you know, shows that cooperation is still sort of front and center, too, for both the U.S. and China and for other countries, too. And so it's nice to see everybody working on this, and bringing them together in that panel was fantastic, too, because we were able to think about what does this mean for the future of our field, how we do research, but also how can we advocate for continuing cooperation and hoping that cooperation expands rather than the opposite.
Fantastic. Hey, while I'm here, I've got Abby Newman here. And Abby is at the University of Chicago Center for East Asian Studies. And Abby, just introduce yourself super quickly and then tell me, what is something that has become clear to you recently in our field?
Hi. Thanks, Kaiser. It's great to see you, as always. My name is Abby Newman. I'm the Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. And every year attending AAS, I'm just reminded, and even though there might be very challenging topics that are discussed, and you can have sessions, whether you're looking at, you know, contemporary legal challenges in Hong Kong right now, even within those challenging conversations, it's inspiring. You see that there are such important spaces where there is hope, and that there are spaces for various voices to continue to be heard. And so when I think about the field, I'm always drawn to those voices and how the programs such as the Association for Asian Studies and the yearly gatherings provide those spaces to continue those conversations and to meet up. So when I think about the field, it's about the spaces and how it's extremely satisfying to meet up and see people, to continue to find those places where you can push all the diverse voices and you can keep pushing for progress and understanding and all of those lovely things.
Thank you. That's one of two in a row now of positivity, which is great, because so many of the others have been sort of, in spite of China closing off, it's still possible to do research. The other thing is the cross-pollination that I see that happens in here. Yesterday, Tyler, your session was so interdisciplinary. I think, you know, when you got up and you ran down, it was law, it was anthropology, it was sociology, it was political science, it was history. It was fantastic. So, yeah, look, the interdisciplinary nature of an area studies gathering like this is great. Thanks, guys.
So Saturday night is the night of all the really big parties, and I went to a couple of excellent receptions and ran into some more great folks who were happy to talk to me. Here's Sophie Loy-Wilson from the University of Sydney.
So Sophie, what is something that in our field has become clear to you recently?
Yeah, I love this question. I suppose I'm really fascinated by the ways in which violence continues to be a kind of, you know, thematic for East Asian historians in a world where I think, you know, I would say that perceptions of violence in the English language are often dominated by U.S. examples, right? And intra-Asian wars, tend to receive in curriculums, and I think in the English language in my country of Australia, less attention. So we have less sympathy for, say, the victims of wars in Asia, that I think, than we have for the victims of wars we more clearly associate with the West. So World War One, for example, you know, the World War II, the European front. So what's really struck me about the field is the ways in which war is being rethought. So both the periodization of war, so when wars begin and end, I think has a more cultural and social dimension. So we're less focused on, say, what an army leader decided to do on a battlefield. We're thinking more specifically about the ideas that might have led to the war in the first place. We're thinking about the ways in which maybe for some people war began earlier, you know, at local level. Mm-hmm. So I think we're kind of expanding the empathy of periodization, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? And I also think that that hopefully, has an anti-war effect. I mean, I think that most historians, I would say, maybe I'm making a bit of a judgment here, are by and large anti-war. I think you can't study war and not become anti-war. I think you can't. And a lot of what we talk about at these conferences is, you know, war, what happened, the lead-up, the decisions, the politicians, you know. And of course, we have in our minds the aftermath. And for a lot of people, this is personal. It's their families, it's their grandparents, great-grandparents, parents, people that have been affected down to intergenerational trauma. And again, I think that in, at least in my country, because we teach wars that we associate more closely with Europe, we don't tend to think about the ramifications of wars in Asia in the same way. I'm not just talking about World War II. I'm talking about things like the Korean War, right? I'm talking about the war in Vietnam. I'm talking about wars in Cambodia. And I just feel like there's very little known in my country about this. It means that when, for example, my partner is Sri Lankan, when people flee wars like the Sri Lankan Civil War, it seems like they're not given the same sympathy as, say, maybe, you know, someone who was a veteran of a more recognizable conflict. So I really like that this conference, as a conference that focuses on Asian history, moves the compassion dial away from those conflicts. And that's what I've come to understand.
Fascinating.
What do you think are some of the drivers of this change? What do you think is happening in people's perception and their understanding of war that's leading this this sea change, which I hope you're correct in diagnosing?
Oh, I love this question. I'm going to cry. I mean, look, I think it comes down, right, Kaiser, don't you think, to our own hopes and aspirations for human beings, right? And their capacity to change. I think we have to believe that, right? At the same time, as I think many historians practice that kind of hope in their work, when they write about these things, they hope will make someone feel more compassionate to another person, different from them maybe, and maybe that will affect their view of others, people who are being othered by their politicians. I think we all hope this. At the same time, we are more than ever in our society able to view the effects of war immediately through our phones, through the internet. Like, we can literally see, you know, in real time, you know, the aftermath of certain kinds of events. It hasn't stopped them though, right? Right?
Well, I've often wondered about the same thing. The immediacy and the sort of visual elements, it both sensitizes people and desensitizes people to conflict. I wonder whether which wins out.
Oh, that's just such a good way of thinking about it, right? Because also, if you think about this question, you know, to the extent to which our exposure to these images or these events or, you know, through new kinds of technology can, yeah, as you say, both draw out our compassion and also do the absolute opposite, dehumanize, distance, right? I think this is reflected in the relationship between historians and their sources. So the foundation of any historical practice is someone believing you can look back at the refuse of the past, whatever's left over in terms of documents, photographs, memories of people, whatever's left over, right? You know, architectural ruins, for example. There's a faith that historians can look at those things and get meaning and insight and hopefully feel and connect, you know, to that person, you know, and that place and that time. So I think what you're kind of talking about is so interesting because it gets down to the presumptions that underlie human knowledge making, right? That if we are studying and learning about something, we'll naturally become more compassionate about it. And I think it's a really important point you raised, Kaiser, because look at like anthropology, that didn't do that. It actually pushed societies away, right? A lot of market research does the same. It commodifies people. So I do wonder about the ways in which we've come to cope with the images we see and maybe the ways in which a certain relationship between technology and capitalism has made us very cynical about our devices, right?
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Thanks. Hey, so I just ran into Joe Dennis, who happens to be at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's an historian, though a pre-modern historian. He's a Ming guy. He has something to say. So what has become clear to you recently, Joe, about our field, about China studies?
Well, in my university, there's certainly a change in the kind of students that are coming. There are fewer people who are interested in doing business with China. The pipeline of students taking Chinese at the university level is moderated a little bit, but we still have a bubble of people who are in Chinese intensive programs in high schools that were created in the last couple of decades who are working their way through the university system. There's also been a surprising increase in the number of Chinese students that are taking Chinese history classes at Wisconsin, which I'm quite excited about. Probably a third of my students are from China, and we still have quite a few students, so there hasn't been a precipitous drop-off in the numbers of students coming from China, which makes me very happy. There perhaps is a slight increase in the number of people studying things related to government and military, but because Wisconsin is not positioned close to the D.C. Government bubble, it's not a large percentage of people who are interested in that at Wisconsin. So I think that would vary quite a bit by the particular institution. I would expect that East Coast universities probably have significantly more, a large number of people interested in government work. We still have a robust program in Chinese culture, and we actually, the number of faculty we have has been holding steady, and we are even making some new hires. So I'm very pleased with that. For example, we had a pre-modern literature scholar retire. He'd been at Wisconsin for 40 years, Bill Nienhauser. And I was very afraid that because he worked on Tang Dynasty and earlier periods, he has a big translation project of the historian's records, the grand scribe's records. Huge, huge project. We have hired a new person that's doing pre-modern Chinese literature. So I'm very happy about that. So I think there's some people feel it's a time of real threat to the profession, to people working on Chinese humanities and other topics related to China. But I don't think it's really hit yet in many places. So I think we're in a time of transition.
Well, fortunately, it hasn't hit your center too badly because they've had at the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, they saw fit to fund a certain current affairs podcast on China. So, hey, thanks, Joe. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Kaiser.
Longtime listeners to the show might remember an interview that I did 4 years ago or so. It was actually at an AAS conference, just sort of on the sidelines up in a hotel room, with the author Ed Pulford, who had written an excellent book called Mirror Lands, which is sort of an anthropological / political book about him threading back and forth across the Sino-Russian border. Now, this, of course, was before the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022. So I asked Ed, just as I've been asking everyone else, to talk about something that's become clear to him about the field recently.
Yeah, it's a pretty difficult question and one which I don't have anything articulate or sophisticated to say, I think, about. But I guess something I've been interested in, for example, in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, or reinvasion, is that when considering, you know, the kind of key question about what China thinks, I guess this is something that people ask about a lot of different situations, including this violent invasion of a neighboring country, you know, a violation of territorial integrity of the kind that the Chinese government has long purported to stand firmly against. We have to kind of take into consideration how paradigms projected from China may be incommensurate or in some ways difficult to reconcile with other ways of thinking about things. And my interest has been in ethnicity and race as one strand of my research interests and whether big states or great powers or, you know, this kind of pregnant family of concepts, whether those kinds of states, in the view of some thinkers in China, might have their own right to define their own field of ethno-racial priority or paradigm, and thus that in some way, and this may be a bit provocative, but is Russia's invasion of Ukraine based on its own special way of thinking about ethnicity and race? Because actually the grounds that Putin offered for the invasion are that the Ukrainians don't really exist, that they're fundamentally the same people as the Russians, and maybe Chinese thinkers, considering that this is a legitimate claim to make, might help to justify the territorial aspect of what Putin's armies have done.
Thanks. That's actually something that I thought about as well, there's a different definition in play when it comes to that. As much as I may completely object to it, that maybe in the minds of some of the Chinese strategic class. Thanks, Ed. Hey, look, it's Emily Metz. And Emily, I've been going around and talking to people and asking them what is something that has become clear to you in the field recently. So, Emily, you're at Georgetown and you're an historian. So what is it for you?
So as I presented on at AAS this weekend, actually, the importance of Marxist dialectics and Mao Zedong thought for Chinese historians, even in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, in which many Western political scientists, historians were saying, like, hey, look, this has kind of died as an ideology. It's not important. It is important. During, you know, the Deng Xiaoping, Gaige Kaifeng, during Jiang Zemin, during Hu Jintao, I mean, it's important throughout for a framework for analyzing modern Chinese history.
So how is it manifesting right now? Like, if you see, you know, dialectical materialism is still important. So what are the theses and antitheses that the Marxist-Leninist of today sees in play?
Yeah, so I look mostly at World War II timelines. So in terms of the Zhuyao Maoduan, the principal contradiction, you have this lively debate going on among Chinese historians from Dongbei, the Northeast, and Beijing, like Beijing Dasue, Tsinghua, Renda, about when the war should begin. But no matter what perspective, which date, whether it be the Mukden incident, as many Dongbei Ren would naturally think should be the starting point, or the Marco Polo Bridge incident, these scholars all utilize this framework of the Zhuyao Maoduan. When does the principal contradiction change? For some, it's the Mukden incident, changing from you know, the proletariat versus the bourgeois, like, class struggle, to under Lenin's theory of imperialism being like, hey, now it's the entire Chinese nation against Japan. But whether that's 1931 or 1937, this narrative of the Zhuyao Maoduan is like assumed to be the correct teleological historical narrative.
That's really interesting, because I mean, I've just been having a discussion earlier about when wars start, and I'm spacing on who it was, but I'll build that in later. But it just fits in well. Hey, thanks so much. That was really fun to talk to you, and thanks for being a listener.
Yeah.
The last little capsule interview in this episode goes to a dear, dear friend of mine, somebody who has done more than just about anyone else I can think of to advance the cause of better U.S.-China relations, and she's been doing it for over 50 years.
Hey, it's Jan Barris, and Jan, of course, is the long-serving vice president of the National Committee on United States-China Relations. It's the last day of this fantastic conference. We just watched an excellent panel on technology policy with some of my very favorite people. I'm asking people, what is something that has become clear to you about our field in recent times?
Actually, Kaiser, it's wonderful to be with you and to have spent the last couple of days seeing each other either across the room or sitting next to one another at these terrific panels. And it's this last panel that sort of coalesced in my mind something that I've been thinking about now for quite some time, but I'm sort of baffled about what we do about it. And that is that I feel that the policies that our government is and has been legislating and thinking about and talking about and converging on is so counterproductive to what the government wants to be doing.
all of this legislation, to my mind, has the exact opposite effect. You don't sell certain things to China. You don't permit them from buying it on the open market. All that does is to increase China's determination to go out and figure out ways to do it themselves. And it just is mind-boggling to me that our very smart people in Washington don't see this. We seem to be so blinded by our own fears and our own concerns. And I firmly believe, I know you want the things that are things that people are thinking about that are new, but this has been a hobby horse of mine for a long time. If we spent one-tenth of the time and the money and the mental capacity and the effort on building up our own strengths and thinking about ourselves as the strong, capable, productive, innovative society that we are, if we return to focusing on that rather than wasting our time trying to figure out ways to keep China down and aside and not being able to compete with us, we would be infinitely better off. And the world would be infinitely better off.
Amen. I absolutely agree. But we make terribly dumb decisions when we are in the throes of a moral panic, which is exactly where we are.
And there is no reason for us to morally panic. We are a society that is so strong. And one of our strengths is because we are so open. I see all of this legislation that's going on and all the conversations we're having is we're closing down. We're becoming just like China. We're becoming the exact same thing we're decrying in them. And that is so stupid.
Amen to that. Absolutely. I hope you've enjoyed this, and I hope it gave you a good sense for the range of just China-focused folks who come to AAS each year. I hope to see you there next year in Columbus, Ohio. Well, I couldn't leave you without a recommendation or two, and it wouldn't have been possible to get recommendations from the, 14 people featured this week. But here's mine. Just in the last month or so, I have become a huge fan of the work of Elle Cordova, E-L-L-E, Elle Cordova, a talented singer, guitarist, songwriter, poet, and maker of brilliant and deeply funny comic sketches that you can find on TikTok, on YouTube, and Facebook. She used to use her stage name, you might know her by Reina Del Cid, but she's gone back to her given name. Her main musical partner is a phenomenally gifted guitarist named Tony Lindgren, who she just plays a gigantic range of styles, everything from bluegrass to folk to country to jazz to pop to rock and roll. And the two of them harmonize beautifully. They both have just lovely voices. Everything about Elle Cordova is just marvelous. She is utterly charming and just so witty, wise, and wonderful. Her acting chops are great. Everything. Just check her out. She's amazing. You will thank me. One more recommendation. While in Seattle, I went to the rehearsal of a great Led Zeppelin tribute band called Presence, which happens to be fronted by Tamar Boursalian, who, again, happens to have been the singer of my college band way back in the mid-80s in Berkeley. Tamar still has the most amazing pipes and just nails all of the Zeppelin material. The other musicians are just phenomenal as well, especially the guitarist Alan, who, as it happens, also speaks really good Chinese. He studied in Taiwan for a while and speaks, actually really good Chinese. So if you're in Seattle and get a chance to see them play out, they're called Presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, you know, after the name of the probably the most obscure Led Zeppelin album. Anyway, don't miss them. Say hi to Tamar for me and pass on a ni hao to Alan as well. That is it for this week. Back next week with a more typical interview format show that you're not going to want to miss. Special thanks to everyone who made this week's episode possible, especially to Maura Cunningham of AAS, who set me up with a press pass. And thanks most of all to all the folks who took time to speak with me, Michael Davidson, Timothy Cheek, Chen Zifeng, Clyde Wang Yicheng, Jeff Wasserstrom, Ian Johnson, Daniel Lees, Tyler Harlan, Abby Newman, Sophie Loy-Wilson, Joe Dennis, Ed Pulford, Emily Mattson, and Jan Barris. You've been listening to the Seneca Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me,
Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at seneca.substack.com, where there is a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio. Or email me at senecapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. And don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.